census taker once tried to test me. I ate his liver with some fava beans and a nice coffee. Now, we may not have the culinary sensibilities of Hannibal Lecter here, but I think most of us enjoy a good quality cup of coffee. And the secret to making the very best coffee is making it while the beans are still freshly roasted. But most coffee you get from shops or from the shelves at your local grocery store are roasted months before they get to you. Thankfully, the internet has solved this problem with sparkplugcoffee.com.
Internet is wonderful.
Sparkplug uses only premium Arabica beans sourced through direct and fairly traded methods. They have many blends to choose from to suit any taste, including decaf and half calf, and they deliver this delicious coffee right to your door. But the best part is that their coffee is always delivered within a week of being custom roasted right here in Toronto, so that it's always fresh and at its peak flavor. You will taste the difference. So if you love great coffee, or you just want to impress that old friend you're having for dinner, it's time to make the switch to Sparkplug Coffee. So plug yourself in at sparkplugcoffee.com.
You set me up in the beginning with the slurp noise and I didn't do it. That deserves points for restrict.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
Hello, Clarice, and welcome to the Top 112 Project, where we continue our quest to review the 123 flicks on the American Film Institute's 1998 and 2007 lists of the coolest American movies. Spoiler alert for a film that you must have seen by now. I am Ryan Ellis, sitting with that connoisseur of liver, beans, and fine wine. She's a well-scrubbed, hustling roux with a little taste. My wife, Bev.
That's me.
And we are in a new location for this podcast. Maybe we'll do this again. It is humid as hell today, so we're downstairs for once.
Yeah, we're in the middle of a late summer heat wave, and the upstairs of our unair-conditioned house is... like we're cooking for a cannibal to eat us later. Like slow roasting us for Hannibal Lecter to enjoy us on a later date.
We'd be delectable, no doubt. But my feet are up and I've been wanting to do this for years.
Yeah, we can't do that in the room upstairs we normally record in.
All right, so just full disclosure for those who really care about
yes.
how we're recording these
people
podcasts.
People who care about Ryan's personal comfort while we're recording the podcast.
I bet they do. Maybe it's a different vibe from this. I heard the Douglas Rain for 2001 recorded his HAL 9000 lines with his shoes off and his feet on a pillow. Made him more relaxed and even keeled. And we're going to mention HAL 9000 in this podcast.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right, anyway, so the coming attractions trivia for this week's film, The Silence of the Lambs. How many AFI movies had a hero and a villain on the top 100 heroes and villains list, with a proviso I should have made last week, but I'm stretching this just a little bit.
I had to pay careful attention to the way you worded it, because for each movie that this is true for in this single movie, there are movies where it's true for a movie and its sequel.
The franchise, essentially.
A franchise, yeah. So, of course, there's Silence of the Lambs. Uh-huh. Lecter and Starling are both represented on the list.
Number one.
And the other films that that's true for in the same film is Schindler's List with Oscar Schindler and Amon
Goethe, I think is how they say it.
Okay.
We're going to learn when we watch it in a few weeks.
Yeah, I know. That's the only one I've never seen yet.
And I forget how they say it, but something like that.
Yeah, and Batman and the Joker from Tim Burton's Batman.
That's correct, but not an AFI film.
Oh, so they have to be AFI films. Well, then it's just... Star Wars is left because Darth Vader is on a list for Empire Strikes Back. So he is a character from Star Wars who's on the villains
That's
list.
That's why it's a bit of a stretch.
Yeah, and Han Solo.
And Alec Guinness playing Obi-Wan Kenobi also is on the heroes list, so you got two.
Mm-hmm.
But you miss one anyway. Both highly ranked, and one of my favorites, It's a Wonderful Life. Mr. Potter's in the top 10, and George Bailey is also on the top 50.
You know, I saw George Bailey on the heroes list, and it didn't even dawn on me to check if Potter was on the villains list, because I don't think he's that great a villain.
He's a terrific villain. He represents exactly, I think we said this on that podcast, what most villainy really is.
Yeah, but he's just such a one-dimensional...
That's true, but he's a banker. Not that all bankers are evil, but what have we seen the last many years that's really messed up the whole planet, certainly where we live in North America? Bad business deals, unfair business practices, that kind of stuff. Way more than what we're going to talk about in a minute with Silence of the Lambs.
That's a good reason why, say, Gordon Gekko is on the villains list. But Mr. Potter is just a mustache-twisting, one-dimensional...
Well, anyway, the point is he's on the
yes.
list.
Yes, okay,
so
fine.
All right, this is a long part trivia question. Anyway, let's get a little bit more into it. So, there's four. Silence of the Lambs, Schindler's List, Star Wars, I made a bit of a stretch, granted, and It's Wonderful Life. There's a bonus to this question, though. I want to ask you this part, and you've all already right. answered one part of it. How many other movies or franchises, not AFI, had a hero and a villain?
Batman has Batman and the Joker.
Right.
Alien in
the original,
one, and Ripley gets it for Aliens for the sequel. And
incidentally, the only other woman in the top 10 on the hero's side,
Starling,
Ellen Ripley. Well, and Starling as well.
Yeah, Starling. But they're the only female heroes
in the top 10, and
which Starling's we'll the definitely ranked. Talk about in today's podcast. I don't know what the fourth one is you're talking about. I missed another one, I guess. But this is my favorite, is that the Terminator is on both the hero and the villains list. For the original Terminator, he's on the villains list. And for the sequel, he's in the heroes list.
I love that, too. The fourth one is Bond and Goldfinger. Bond is technically from Dr. No. That's just the first movie. That's probably why they picked him. Even though it's
that.
The movie that most people don't think of as the premier Bond film. Even though it literally was the premier, as in first Bond film. And then Auric Goldfinger from that movie.
Yeah, I really missed that one.
Eight movies in total have heroes and villains on each side. We've talked enough about this. Let's move on. But that is a great lead into this film with an incredible hero and two great villains, actually. Not just one. So the Top 100 Projects Flickr Show number 112, The Silence of the Lambs, was 65th on AFI's 1998 Top 100 between Close Encounters of the Third Kind and Network. Then took a bit of a plunge to 74th, a bit of a surprising plunge, I'd say, in 2007 between Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, which also dropped, and a newcomer that year in The Heat of the Night. Our final Orion film premiered in L.A. on February 1st, 1991. Then it bloodied up theaters on Valentine's Day. I love that that was when it got fully released. The medium-budget film was a huge success. Now, Bev will explain that big success for you with a skinny.
Jodie Foster is FBI trainee Clarice Starling. She's tasked with interviewing imprisoned psychiatrist Hannibal the Cannibal Lecter, who might be able to help feds track down serial killer Buffalo Bill. Ted Levine is Buffalo Bill, who kidnaps women for grisly purposes. Of course, Dr. Lecter is played with gusto by Anthony Hopkins.
For the first of three times. We'll talk about the sequels, of course, as we go along. Or, in a nutshell, confused Taylor's dance party is rudely interrupted. Or, my original nutshell, physician prepares surprise reunion with fellow physician. Yes. As he has his old friend, Padena. How many impersonations will be done in this podcast?
You do a much better Lecter impression than I do.
I'll try not to milk it too much. All right, some numbers. The Rotten Tomatoes critics, 94% of them are fans of this movie, 68 fresh, 4 rotten, and 95% of audiences. That's pretty impressive. And it's 23rd on the IMDb 250.
Mm.
We mentioned it every once in a while because there are some debatable choices in there. And there's also some ones in there that were never really popular with audiences or critics at the time. And that's one way they can be rewarded all time, because anybody can vote on that if they want to. And there's one of our downfalls of being downstairs. Our fridge is not too far away if you hear that in the background. Anyway, Silence of the Lambs was fourth on the 1991 U.S. box office. Terminator 2, already mentioned earlier, was number one. Enough about numbers. Bev, give us your thoughts.
Unfortunately, the effect of it has been watered down by decades of sequels and the prequels and the copycats. The general cultural ubiquity of it, which is just evidence of what a phenomenon it was. Mm-hmm. But I can still acutely remember how effective it was when I first saw it 24 years ago. It terrified me. I was so completely wrapped up. I have this really good memory of watching that scene in Buffalo Bill's house at the end when Starling's in the dark and he has the glasses on. I was literally at the edge of my seat. And these thrills aren't cheap either. There's enough depth to make repeated viewings really rewarding. It was an instant classic then. And for my money, I think it's on par with Psycho. I can't believe it dropped between 98 and 2007.
Well, that surprised me too. I would have thought it would have gone up. Because the movie's influenced so many things, and because people still love it to this day, if you mention to a casual film fan, they've seen the movie, and most people like it, or at least respect what it has to offer. And like you said, they were scared by it. All right, let's get into something right off the bat that we talked about with the only other horror films we've had in this list so far. We've covered others for the Not 100 Project, but Frankenstein and Psycho, we have one more with Sixth Sense, almost at the end of the project, and the other two, Jaws and Silence of the Lambs, do they fit this description? Your sister Pam objected when we said on, I think it was Frankenstein, must have been, that there's only three horror films in the whole list, and Silence of the Lambs is two, a horror film. She texted you, I believe is what it was. We didn't agree. Now that it's been all this time, Jaws is action-adventure with this monster. It's more of a monster movie, I guess, but you could call it horror. Silence of the Lambs is a cop thriller, mostly, but then there's these grisly things with these incredible villains, one of whom doesn't do anything until his character's pretty much out of the movie, that being Lecter, and the other one doesn't really do anything ever that we see on screen. It's more about the aftermath of what he's done and what he's going to do to his next victim.
Mm-hmm.
But let's answer that question all these podcasts later after Frankenstein. Is this horror or is it not horror?
Well, since we are the definitive voice and deciders of what genre any film fits into, I mean, I say that to joke because I find separating films into genres and nitpicking about this kind of stuff inane and unnecessary, but I've never considered it a horror film because it doesn't have any supernatural elements, so it doesn't have that traditional definition of a horror film.
Neither does Psycho.
Neither does Psycho. Psycho, I don't know, horror film, if you say so. To me, it's really a thriller because it doesn't have the gore of a slasher flick and it doesn't have the supernatural ghosts or zombies or something of a traditional horror film. So it's a thriller to me, but people want to call it a horror film. Because there is some pretty horrific violence that, like you say, we only really see the aftermath of. One of the great things about this film is its restraint when it comes to the violence in a way that makes it far more scary. And like they always say, what's in your head is going to be worse than anything they can show on screen. And it's a very scary film, so that could make it a horror film, I suppose. But I would call it a thriller.
Here's another angle on this I want to bring up, though. If this is a horror film, it's still the only bona fide one to win the Oscar for Best Picture.
Yes.
Exorcist was the first ever to be even nominated for Best Picture, and then Jaws. Well, again, is that really a horror film? But also nominated 2 years after Exorcist. Neither of those won. So there's that wrinkle. The other wrinkle, is this actually the second sequel to win Best Picture? Obviously, The Godfather Part 2 was number one, and everyone always says Lord of the Rings, The Return of the King was number two. But this was preceded by Manhunter.
Yeah.
And then that was remade as Red Dragon, when Hopkins played the character. Brian Cox played Lecter before anybody else. He even spelled his name differently. He played him much differently than Hopkins does, where he's, let's face it, he's over the top, but he's a lot of fun. We'll get into Hopkins specifics in a few minutes. But no one really ever brings that up. It's a sequel.
Yeah, but then you get into the nitty-gritty of, is it a sequel? Is it a reboot? And those are words that have definitely become more important as we live in the age of reboots and sequels with all the comic book movies and action franchises that are being redone.
All right, I just want to bring that up, though, because that is something that is overlooked a lot of the times. As I said a few minutes ago, two classic villains. Not many movies of any kind have featured two scary bad guys. I always say Return of the Jedi, as much as it's maligned by people, that movie has villains we've never saw before. Jabba the Hutt, in the original release at least, before he's digitally inserted in the other movies. And the Emperor, who's mentioned and shown here and there, he's in charge of the whole universe. So they're including new villains we never saw before. But most movies struggle to find one memorable one. Here you got two. I think if Hopkins didn't do the kind of job he did, and people love it, still even now, here's some numbers I'm going to give away. Number one villain. We didn't even say that before, actually. Number six for Clarissa on the hero side. Number one for Lecter.
Better than Darth Vader.
Or Norman Bates.
Or Norman Bates.
Which I find disputable, actually. I like the character, but that's a little bit much. But it's because he's smarter than us, maybe?
It's because the movie makes us like him, too. He's one of the most despicable villains on the outside. If you were to just have his features described to you, he's a cannibal, for God's sakes. He's so reliably violent that they can't even trust him to behave in the prison setting, that he will go out of his way just to cause people pain when he can't reach them, whether it's talking his neighbor into killing himself or torturing Clarice by calling her Poe white trash and picking on her, just trying to hurt people's feelings. He's a sadist to the nth degree, but at the end of the movie, we like him and we're rooting for him. Maybe it's because he likes Clarice. Mm-hmm. And so we're kind of rooting for both of them together because he's rooting for our hero and he's not the one who's actually keeping a woman in the pit.
And he does help her.
And he does help save Catherine.
When she first meets him, he's like a shark on display in that aquarium thing he's got going on. He's standing there. That was his idea, just to be standing. Good morning. Very polite and normal, not going for anything over the top. And when she looks at the picture he's been painting, that is the Duomo scene from the Belvedere, which is somewhere over in Europe, I think Italy. Buffalo Bill is in Belvedere, Ohio. He knows who James Gum is the whole time. So of course she can't pick up on that. Who could be expected to get that clue? But he's telling her in the first sentence he ever says to her after good morning, he's in Belvedere.
Yeah, and he's already been interviewed by other FBI agents. So he knows exactly what they're looking for. He knows exactly what Clarice is looking for. And he toys with her for days and days.
But you said he likes her, and you're right. That's the key thing. I love the line she has to her roommate, Ardelia, and that's Cassie Lemon. She made Eve's Bayou several years later. Clarice says to her, he would find it rude.
To come after her, like after he escapes from prison.
And he says as much when he calls her. Mm-hmm. Well, it's more interesting with you, isn't it, Clarice?
Mm-hmm.
I kind of buy that. What reason would he have to go after her? He wants to go after, as we know at the end of the movie, Chilton to get revenge on him for being a torturous psychiatrist to a fellow psychiatrist, as it turns out.
Yeah, well, I buy it because Clarice buys it. Because she's smart and she gets things and she figures things out. And she's right most of the time. So when she estimates that he wouldn't come after her and she seems pretty comfortable in that assumption, I trust that she's correct.
He avoids blinking, not always, but almost always. Mm-hmm. When he's first psychoanalyzing her in his old cell, not in the later on cell, He turns away from her, and he does blink, and there's something about her childhood, some painful memory. They both have blue eyes, incidentally, which is an interesting touch, because you can go the technical route of having the good guy has the blue eyes, and the bad guy has the black or the brown eyes. But anyway, so those blue eyes blink, and it's almost like, I feel your pain, Clarice. He wants to be a psychiatrist. As much as you say, and you're right, that he wants to torture people and play with Clarice just because it amuses him, he also still wants to do his old job.
And he's a victim of abuse as well. It's not really not made clear in the film, and Demme actually said, Jonathan Demme, the director, said that was one of the regrets that he had, that he didn't make it clear enough.
I think it's in that book.
Lecter...
I read Silence of the Lambs a long time ago.
Oh, okay.
One of the few books I've read that was turned... I've read it so long ago, I can't really address that much. But anyway, go ahead.
Oh, but the character of Lecter was abused as a child, so it could be a bit of sympathy that perhaps is part of the reason why he came around to Starling. He doesn't like her at first, but he grows to like her, partially because she's really bright and she gets it, and I think that he has a kinship with her because they're the smartest people in the room. He's smarter because he's impossibly smart. He's such an insane genius. Everything about him is a little bit over the top, which is part of why we like him, and Hopkins doesn't hold back. Well, he does hold back, but let's face it, he's playing him a little bit over the top, and we love him for it.
He mixed the voices of Truman Capote and Katharine Hepburn.
Isn't that great?
Oh, and
you mentioned this right at the beginning, HAL 9000.
Yeah, not the voice, but the idea behind the calm murderer.
The voice, the character is a combination of
those.
Or
so the tempo, you mean the low, even-keeled tempo of the voice.
Well, and I guess maybe his mannerisms too, because how else could he... All HAL 9000 is a voice, so how could he not?
Yeah, right, of course.
And you mentioned the cell. In the book, the cell is like a mesh... But they couldn't shoot it like that because that would just make it impossible to see what's going on in the cell.
And bars is boring. I think Demme said that.
Yeah, so they opted with the plexiglass. It was somebody's idea. In order to make the set properly, they had to just trap Hopkins in there all day. Since that's the only way that him and Jodie Foster do scenes together, they actually never got to be in the same room together. The crew and the cast would all take off, go to their trailers, eat their lunch, whatever. He was trapped in there all day and kind of kept separated from everybody. Like a prisoner in a cell would be, but it helped them stay in character.
Luckily, the whole movie isn't about those, too. He's only in the movie for about 23 or 25
isn't
minutes.
Isn't that incredible?
Like that.
He made
one
such
of the
an impression.
Shortest performances in the history of a Best Actor or Actress Oscar. And people have said for many years, they probably said in 1991, into 92 when the awards were actually given out, that that's not a Best Actor, it's the Best Supporting Actor. But Orion, who was going bankrupt, we talked about Orion plenty lately, Dances with Wolves last week. They produced that movie and won the Oscar, and it was a huge hit. And they released Amadeus and Platoon, also big hits, also won the Best Picture Oscars. But they were going under, and they managed to wrestle up enough money for an Oscar campaign. And I'm sure one of the reasons why would be the idea that they were going to get the big five. They got Best Picture, they got Best Director, Best Actor, Best Actress, and Best Screenplay. And you weren't going to get that if he's a supporting actor in the movie. What are the other two movies? People who really follow this stuff would know this.
I looked this up because I knew you would ask. They are both AFI pictures. One is It Happened One Night.
One of our very
first
ones.
The old Capra, yeah. One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
That's right.
And you know, Nurse Ratched, also a great villain. Also on the list of best villains from Heroes and Villains.
She is.
And also somebody who doesn't really have that much screen time. It makes such an incredible impression.
Probably more of a supporting character, too. It's true. Yeah, well, that's all debatable anyway, because there's so many times where a big star would get top billing. Marlon Brando is the best example of that. In Apocalypse Now and Superman, in a couple of years there, he's top billed in movies where he's barely in them. But it's because it's Marlon Brando. So we keep talking about Hopkins. Let's not forget, he was, in a way, in Spartacus, an AFI film we covered 52 AFI movies ago. And that was because he and Tony Curtis re-recorded dialogue and Laurence Olivier had died. Hopkins, they said, did a good impression of Olivier.
I forgot about that.
It's all that good. But that was inserted later on. It's the oysters and shells theme implying homosexuality. Oh, there's a lead-in to Jodie Foster. I don't bring it up because she's a lesbian, but I bring it up because, is Clarice Starling a lesbian?
It's irrelevant, really.
It is irrelevant, but the reason why I ask is because in the book, I do remember this thing, Jack Crawford, Scott Glenn's character, his wife is dying. I think in the TV series Hannibal, that's a more major theme. We didn't keep watching it. We'll talk about that series later on. But the wife is dying, and Crawford has been dealing with this for a long time, so he has a bit of an attraction to Starling. He can't let it get in the way of business, and also she's a colleague anyway. So when Lecter asks, does Jack Crawford ever think about touching, fucking? Honestly, Doctor, that does man harass me. So does that make her even more sympathetic towards the women in this movie? Not that she wouldn't be, not that they all aren't, but she can understand their plight even more because she's physically small, she's young, she's new at this, she's not even actually an FBI agent yet. She's dealing with not only terrible people, but these horrific killers. And then she doesn't know this is about to happen to her at the end of the film, but she's in the house with the guy. Mm-hmm. But is that one more little twist that's supposed to be in there too, that she's actually different in that way as well? And let's not forget, this is 1991. That would have been a bigger deal. Oh my God, a lesbian lead character. Not that that's a key point, but I just wonder, is that some kind of underlying hint there?
The key point is that she's not interested. Whether she is straight but just focused on her career, or gay and not interested in any of these guys in there hitting on her, and they are hitting on her. She's always in rooms filled with men where she's sometimes the only woman, and certainly the only woman of authority who has the same job as these guys rather than a secretary or server or something like that. And Demme intentionally shot her always from the perspective of the male gaze. Mm-hmm. He would shoot her from POV shots of the male characters in the room. Most noticeable scene, she walks into an elevator coming from the obstacle course, and she's in an elevator with six or eight guys, and they're all at least a head taller than her, mm-hmm. and she just stands there trying to pretend it doesn't bother her, but you know it must, and I don't care who you are, you've got to empathize with her in that moment that she walks in that elevator. I've been in elevators like that before, and I know what that feels like, but it's just such a perfect encapsulation of what she's up against. Part of what she's up against is the sexual gaze of all these men. The fact that she's pretty. She didn't choose to be pretty. She's not trying to get their attention. As a matter of fact, she has all these strategies that you see to deflect these men's attention. Mm-hmm. I choose to see it just as she's a professional. She's very serious about her career. She's been given an incredible opportunity. She does not care for the distraction. These men are in a position where they can afford to be distracted by a pretty girl and to go after her and let that pull their focus. She has to catch this killer, not just because she's an ambitious, and she is a very bright FBI trainee and she's very ambitious, but also she desperately wants to save this woman.
She's the lamb.
Catherine is the lamb, and that's such a beautiful speech. To answer your question, it's completely irrelevant.
But see, I bring it up because it leads into the other main character in this film. Okay, Scott Glenn's third build, and he's fine in the film, but he's not the other main character. It's clearly Buffalo Bill.
Yes.
James Gunn, played by Ted Levine, who is not a traditional transsexual. He's a phony transsexual. Lecter even says so, and he was his patient. He should know this. He wants to be with men. The book actually makes this pretty explicit, too. I keep saying I don't remember the book, but I do remember more about his character because we get voiceover from him that we're not going to get in this movie. There's no voiceover whatsoever. And we don't really get much of him either. He's also, as great as he is, not in the movie that much. But I recall a sequence where he can't wash his own penis. He's got to lift it up with a rag or something like that to wash himself. He won't actually use his own hands to touch his own skin. Mm-hmm. He hates his own body that much. And as Lecter says, he's been abused so much. He wasn't born a monster. He was made that way by years of abuse. So there's a guy who probably isn't gay, certainly isn't transsexual in the typical sense, but of all these people, he has sexuality issues more than anyone else.
The book and the movie, they just try to dip into every possible well of things that make people uncomfortable. So whether it's not being able to see in a room where someone else can see you, the labyrinth of closed doors and cavernous basements, so it's being trapped in a well, it's being trapped in a plexiglass cell, it's being trapped in a room with somebody who's a cannibal. You know, all these things that horrify us. Even being trapped in an elevator with a bunch of intimidating men who are taller than you.
Or in the room, the deputy's office, when they're investigating one of the bodies. Mm-hmm. She's got to take charge. Listen here now. And they don't really want to listen to her. They do in the end. The other one that I have to point out is pointed out on the commentary. I think it's Jonathan Demme, but a lot of people speak in the commentary. So I forget who it is. The most terrifying image in a movie is a closed door.
Roger Corman said that. Yeah, it's a camera approaching a closed door.
And they do have that when she goes down into the basement after he tries to get away and get on those goggles and stalk her.
Demme and Thomas Harris, who wrote the novel, they pulled everything from their bag of tricks to make people uncomfortable. And part
also
of that,
Ted Talley, the guy who adapted the novel.
Oh, yes. Yeah, absolutely. And Levine, who played the character of Buffalo Bill. It's 1991. I don't think that you would draw a character this way if you were writing this book today, because people feel very differently about being transgendered and that community, and even just people understand it way more, which means that we don't get freaked out about it, because there's probably a lot of us even know somebody who's transsexual. It's not really mysterious or weird anymore, but in 1991, if you wanted to reach into that bag of tricks to make people as uncomfortable as possible, having a transgendered character who's not really transgendered, and they even say it, is a great way to add to that.
And had he finished that suit of women, which we briefly see, let's say he'd managed to finally get that done, and then he went out to the bars to find the guys, and they came back with him, would they have even gone that far? They would have been horrified. We see how he stitched it together. The guy is a decently talented tailor, but it still looks pretty terrible. If they ever tried to actually get physical, and well, not just touching, but I'm talking fucking. I thought about this because it reminded me a little bit, and this is a weird connection, but we're going to make two connections to Kevin Smith, and here's the first one. Tusk. That was not a good movie, but a guy is turned into a walrus, and somewhere in there is the body wearing this suit of skin and other shit, too. But had Buffalo Bill managed to make this work, he's kind of Tusk.
You know, I had not gone down the rabbit hole of wondering what would happen if Buffalo Bill ever accomplished his goal of creating a woman suit, but I imagine it would kind of be like his little private dance party that he has, where it's not really something he would do outside the house. I mean, he's not a very social guy, so maybe he would just wear it at home.
I'm basing this on the fact that I think from the novel, that is what he's doing it for. It is to get guys. It isn't just to wear this and show your power, and oh, I'm this beautiful, wonderful creature. He actually wants to wear it to win men.
Imagine being the guy that he approaches and tries to talk to wearing a suit of other people's skin. Mm-hmm. Oh, man alive. Yeah, he is creepy. He is great. And Ted Levine is amazing. There's something uncanny and just so viscerally creepy about him. The scene, the famous scene. We talk about two great villains. People quote the lotion in the basket.
Put the fucking lotion in the basket!
People quote that almost as much as they quote Lecter. It's an incredible moment, and he sells it. Or when he's pulling the nipples out on his shirt and yelling with Catherine. It's absolutely terrifying.
Partly because, unless they get lucky, and Clarice does to a huge extent get lucky, how are they ever going to find this girl, and the next girl, and the next girl? Because they're in some basement, in some fairly well-secluded property. She can scream as much as he wants to, and so can the next one, and obviously the ones before did. No one's ever going to find them. We've learned that people really do this in real life, though, too. Not to create a skin of women, but just to keep people trapped away.
And oh, yeah.
Things even worse, really, than just killing them. I mean, some people have been tortured sexually by guys for years.
Yeah, part of what makes those scenes work really well is the character of Catherine, played by Brooke Smith. I don't know if a lot of people would necessarily recognize her from stuff. I always know her from this indie film called Series 7.
Absolutely.
How old is that? 10, 15
2001,
years?
2001, I think it was.
2000, oh, so almost 15 years old. Also, one of the first films for Merritt Weaver. She was like a teenager in that movie. I can't say it's an amazing film that I would necessarily recommend to everybody, but it's always stuck in my mind. It was very interesting.
Brooke Smith is a pregnant woman with a gun in her hand stalking people because the whole point of it is to kill to survive.
Yeah,
it's so
good.
It's the opposite of what she has to do in this movie.
It's a little bit Hunger Games meets Survivor, back when reality television was still a new thing and people were kind of wondering just how far it could go.
It's a memorable role.
Oh,
people
yeah.
probably haven't seen it. Most people wouldn't have anyway. But yeah, that's what I think of when I think of her even more than this movie.
And she stands out so much. She was also in Grey's Anatomy. I've seen
a lot
her
of TV appearances.
Yeah, exactly. She's not a Hollywood look. She isn't a Hollywood pretty. She's a character actress. She does a lot of stuff like that. But I've always liked her. I've always kind of rooted for her. She's great in this. She's absolutely perfect as a terrified victim stuck in that hole, reacting how you imagine anybody would react in an unbelievable situation like that.
Well, we're talking about women pitchers again, in a way, with Series 7, because that's definitely woman-driven. One thing I want to get back to just briefly about Foster being an Academy Award winner and the lead of the film. We've covered not that many, but almost every time we've covered a woman's film lately, it's won an Oscar for the actress. Sophie's Choice, woman issues film, she's the lead, Meryl Streep, best actress winner. Annie Hall, Diane Keaton, Best Actress winner. I mean, that's not necessarily a feminist film, but she is co-lead, at least. She's got a pretty major role in that. And we're going to cover Fargo, with a woman cop who's actually an experienced cop, and a very good one, Marge Gunderson.
It's funny that you're calling these women issue films or feminist films. Really, the only thing that stands out about them is that, with Annie Hall being the exception, you have a woman playing the hero.
But that is unusual. That's why I'm
that
saying
is
that.
Unusual. Like,
maybe
the,
not
the
woman
fact
issue
that
films,
that, no, but the fact that that makes it a feminist film points out exactly why we need more feminist films. We need more films with women in lead roles. Only about 25% of speaking roles, period, in films go to women. Actresses are very underemployed in Hollywood. And as soon as you hear that statistic and you start watching films and just looking around, you see how incredibly true and sad that is. And it's 2015. What is taking so long? What is amazing about Silence of the Lambs? And I do agree that it is a feminist film, not just because it has a female lead, but because she's just the hero. She's just a woman saving another woman, not because she's her sister or her daughter or her lover or anything like that. She doesn't even have a romance. Do you know how refreshing it is to see a woman be a hero and not have a romance? Another great example, you mentioned her, the other female hero on the hero and villains list, Ripley. Mm-hmm. No romance. She's just kicking ass because she kind of has to, because she's put in a situation and she's no nonsense, but she's still very much a woman. She's not pretending to be a man. She's not succeeding because of her resemblance to a man. She just happens to be competent. Mm-hmm. And Marge Gunderson is another great example.
Who's already married.
Yeah, but again, no romance. Because in a situation like that, it should be irrelevant.
And in this movie, Clarice starts off on a solo mission, running the obstacle course. She's all by herself. Mm-hmm. Interesting mm-hmm. technique there. And then for most of the movie, she works alone. Ardelia helps her by talking through some things, and obviously they're friends doing the same kind of stuff because they both graduate together. Obviously, Ardelia mm-hmm. is very capable as well. But Crawford only ever talks to her briefly, at least what's presented in the film. And obviously, Lecter's helping her, but she only ever sees him, I think it's 4 times.
Something that's refreshing about them and their relationship, too, is that he picks her because she stood out, not just because she's pretty and he needs a young woman to get Lecter's attention. And he trusts her. He considers her competent and he lets her take charge. And when she says to him, you really set the tone. And
it matters. It matters. Crawford.
And he says, yeah, you're right. He really respects her.
He learned a lesson.
The way they portray the sexism that she faces in this movie feels really authentic to me.
We keep talking about Clarice Starling's competence. How about some incompetence? They seem like nice enough guys, and maybe they were good cops in ordinary situations, but not so much in this one. Pembry and Boyle, their shit is the loosest wired shit you've ever seen.
They're the cops in Tennessee charged with keeping Hannibal Lecter in his cell.
And now he's in bars, mm-hmm. interestingly. Although if they had had their shit wired tight, it maybe wouldn't have mattered so much. It's funny how that's presented, and of course he's got to get out somehow. It could be the Hitchcock answer. If he didn't do it this way, how is he ever going to get out if they actually watched him closely? Oh, let me backtrack, actually, before we get into those sequences when he actually goes to meet up with the Senator Ruth Martin. Love your suit. The pen is laid on the bed, and the guy who lays all these rules out, Dr. Chilton, is the one who messes it up, who basically allows Lecter to get away. It's never beaten to death. We see Lecter staring at the pen, but it's not type close-ups mm-hmm. exactly either. And then the book explains it, but the movie never explains how he gets the pen there, and it's that he doesn't hit the whole pen, it's just part of it, so he can make a key to break open the handcuffs, because he must figure this is what it's going to be, and if it's not, what does he get to lose? I'll put this in my mouth, but they're never going to check. I'm not going to put their fingers in there, or my anus. Think again, the book has him do that. And then when I get where I'm going, if I ever need this, I've got it. That's good filmmaking, though, because it doesn't fully explain. It probably confused people. And then when he actually kills Pembry and Boyle, the way he gets away, that confused me when I read the book. I had to reread that chapter and thought, what the fuck? Why is Pembry attacking the hospital guys mm-hmm. in the ambulance? But of course, he's got his face on. And that's a great technique, too, because they know this guy eats people. He would have pretended to have eaten the face enough that, of course, you're not going to mess with that because it's just hanging on there. The guy laying on the floor, but that's, of course, the face has been carved off altogether, so that's a brilliant technique, too. We said their shit wasn't wired tight, but that whole sequence is great, so I'll give him the slack that those cops are kind of incompetent. But when he breaks free, is the first time he ever does anything in the movie other than talk. And then when he uses that baton to kill Boyle, Charles Napier, who's in a lot of Corman movies, and Jonathan Demme used him quite a few times too. He's the one who gets batoned to death. And the way the Lecter uses it is more like a conductor than it is a mass murderer.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, you've got the gentle music playing in the background too. But that leads into the grisly murders that he does commit. Stringing up Boyle and his guts hanging out in that Francis Bacon-esque pose, which is way over the top. And as we said when we took a break just after that scene, why would he waste so much time just to make a point? The guy's already dead.
Just get out of there. Yeah. You're breaking out of prison.
We get why you took off Pembry's clothes yep. and put on yourself and you put your clothes on him and did a good job covering the face off. That's necessary for your breakout. But the Boyle thing, just leave him on the goddamn cell.
Yeah, that was an indulgence of Demme's and probably of Harris as well, where they just wanted that horrifying scene.
And great visual, but yes. a little silly.
But then the next thing you see is that great mislead with the elevator, too.
Mm-hmm.
Where you don't even know as the audience what's going on. And I remember finding it confusing as well the first time I saw the film. What happened? Why is he there? Who's in the elevator shaft?
And they don't really fully explain it to you. And maybe they don't really have to. Maybe it takes multiple viewings to fully get what's going on. As I said, I had to flip back in the chapter. But that's an incredibly tense scene. Not horrifying so much. Well, it is when you see all the blood and guts everywhere. But more about tension after he's committed those acts on those guys. And Chris Isaac has a cameo. Almost always some kind of musician gets into Demme's films in some role. I think it's the SWAT commander.
Mm-hmm.
And their shit is wired remarkably tight.
Why do you have these two boneheads watching the cell when you have the world's best SWAT team downstairs in case something goes wrong? Maybe they should be the ones up there. How long is this shift that no one's checking in on these guys? But there's no cameras, there's no audio equipment or anything else to keep an eye on them like there would be in any other prison in the 90s. Just these two old dopey cops that are screwing up. Meanwhile, the SWAT team's just hanging out in case something goes wrong.
So that leads us to the ending of the film. We don't have Lecter on screen for quite a long time. We don't need him anymore. He didn't really do his job with Clarice, but it doesn't matter anyway. He rewards himself, though, for what he did help Clarice do by saying the Belvedere earlier on, I suppose, with this permanent vacation. And he's going to start by going after Chilton in the Bahamas. I like the touch. I don't know if it was deliberate or not, but it's gray there. It's the fucking Bahamas. And it seems like a storm is coming, probably a deliberate mm-hmm. touch as well. And then the last shot of the film, the credits play out over it and never goes to black until the credits are fully played out and then the movie's just fully over. Lecter just walks into the crowd and disappears because that's his future now. This standout human being as a brain, as a psychopath, all those ways that we respect him, the number one AFI villain in the history of movies, and he's just a face in the crowd now.
Because that's what a smart person would do.
And if you watch Hannibal, that's what he has done for, I think it's 5 or 6 years, maybe even longer, and he is over in Europe living a life, and he didn't ever go after Clarice, as we know. Okay, a little bit more about Jodie Foster. This is her second of two AFI films, so she's done. She was in Taxi Driver. What a different character that was, because there she is somebody who has to be saved. Well, she doesn't want to be saved, but according to De Niro's character, she does. And now she's the savior. And her other Oscar win before this was for The Accused, where she wasn't saved. A terrible thing happens to her, and no one saved her. The rape that happens, and I've never seen that movie a second time. Don't really want to. But now this time, she's the one saving that lamb. And it could have been Michelle Pfeiffer. Jodie Foster was sure, even though she wanted this part very badly, that it would be Pfeiffer because she'd worked with Demi on the Married to the Mob. Yeah. But Pfeiffer didn't really like the violence past, and I think Foster was next on the list. And then she pretty much won Demi over with her determination.
She said that she really wanted to do it because it was a female hero, untraditional, the ways we talked about.
I think the time in the movie she cries is when she first sees Lecter and she goes out and cries in her car.
Mm.
She talked with the FBI people. They really provided some help with this, by the way. John Douglas, he's also on the commentary. He gave Scott Glenn some tapes of what serial killers had done. And Scott Glenn said he heard only a matter of minutes of it, so that's enough for me, and he's never forgotten it ever since.
He was vehemently against the death penalty before he did his research for this role, and John Douglas helped turn him around to become a death penalty proponent. It was one particular serial killer who had audio tapes of torture they had done to some of their victims, some of them teenagers. These audio tapes were so gruesome, so horrifying, that he changed his mind about the death penalty.
Let's not go on about this too much more, but one thing I gotta say in response to that is, if you keep somebody in prison for the rest of their life, that is a punishment in itself. As long as they're in maximum security and not going anywhere. Paul Bernardo, the guy here in Canada that people know about, he's never going to go anywhere. You kill somebody, you can never take that back. If we ever find out that they didn't do it, it's always possible that somebody's innocent. We've found out so much with DNA evidence, the number of people that have died who shouldn't have been killed in America. We don't really do that here. Death penalty can be understandable in the case of a Bernardo or someone like Charles Manson. But I get Scott Glenn's point of view, though.
But
I didn't listen to those tapes.
You would also change your mind if you heard those tapes.
That's a good point. Who knows? Yeah, sure. But anyway, she does cry in that one sequence, and it's just a stress relief, is what they were talking about. The FBI person that was talking to her said, sometimes you just let it out as the emotions come out.
Of course.
Because you can't do it during the scene. She can't let Lecter get into her head, as Crawford says. And I think she also, it's never said as much, but maybe she respects him enough to say, if anyone's ever going to hear me say these things, maybe I'm going to let you do it because you seem to want to know so badly. And even does say, thank you, Clarice. And it's not thank you as in, hey, thank you, you piece of shit. It's more like, you let me do my job again. For that, I respect you and like you.
And that speech, it's wonderful. It's not too much, but it's remarkable in that...
The lamb speech.
The lamb speech, yeah. It's remarkable because you're kind of expecting to hear some revelation about a trauma in her past, maybe about her father's death or her mother's death. But instead you get this little snapshot that's so important to her, and it's revealing because all it is revealing. It's not a trauma so much as just the moment that she as a character realized who she always was. Demi and Harris say the point is a hero is born a hero. That wasn't the moment something happened and shaped her. That was the moment that she realized who she always was going to be, which was a hero.
And yet she failed.
Yes, which is her motivator for not failing again, for saving Catherine this time.
And in that case, she was just simply too small. She was a little kid trying to carry a lamb. That's not going to want to go with you. It's fighting you the whole way.
It's such a heartbreaking story. But maybe because I love animals.
And when she told that story, Demi said, well, I guess we aren't going to shoot any B-roll after all, because they were going to show it. And that's great directorial technique. We've seen a lot of times B-roll can help a sequence, something like that. Many other times you just shoot the performer's face and let them play it out like she does, almost crying, not quite. You don't need to do anymore. And he was right to say that and to know that and not go back on it later and say, oh, let's spend the money and go to get those shots. You don't need it. This is a weird example to compare to, but I always think about this, a movie called Your Friends and Neighbors. Jason Patrick talks about how he raped a guy when they were both teenagers. He tells the story. You never see anything else. I think they must cut to the other guys in the gym, wherever the hell they are, as he explains what happened. It's not as awful as you might think.
It's not how you would expect that scene to play out, for sure.
Yes, let's put it that way. But it's so visual. You can see the whole thing happening without ever seeing anything other than him describe it and those guys react to it. And that is exactly what you're seeing in Silence of the Lambs as well. So Mr. Hopkins wasn't the guy who's going to get this role. He was nowhere near number one because Gene Hackman had originally bought the rights. He also would have directed it. He's never directed any movies. Well, he's retired now, essentially. He's not going to direct now. But the story goes, he saw himself during the Oscar clips when he was nominated for Mississippi Burning, and it's a violence sequence. He's always said he hates violence, even though three of his most famous characters and all three AFI characters are very violent. The one in Bonnie and Clyde, the one in The French Connection, the one in Unforgiven, which we do next week. I guess he sold his rights or pass or something. But he would have played Lecter, made the right choice in passing on. He would have been good because Hackman's always good. And there's a lot of other people that are always in the running for this kind of thing. Even though this guy's a huge star and it would be fun, I don't think Sean Connery is right for it at all.
No.
He has the menace for it.
No.
But Brian Cox, who had played him in Manhattan in 86, would have been very good for sure. And I've read reviews where people say they prefer that version of Lecter. And Lecter's been played by so many other people now. Mads Mikkelsen plays him in the TV series. Mm-hmm. Let's just talk about that now. We saw, what, 4 episodes? We didn't like it. We didn't stick with it. We don't know where the hell it's gone. We don't really care.
It does what Silence of the Lambs doesn't do. Silence of the Lambs doesn't show the violence. It shows the aftermath of violence. It shows the reaction to violence. Possibly a great example is the autopsy scene. You see the reactions of all the agents who are seasoned agents who presumably have seen it all. And their reactions to getting a look at this corpse is all that you need to know. You see the corpse, but really it's more gruesome that these guys, these vets, are grossed out by it.
And also Clarice's reaction when Chilton shows what Lecter had done to a nurse many years before.
Yeah.
In the prison.
And in the show Hannibal, you see so much violence.
Isn't it the very first shot of the pilot where there's blood
that's
literally
blood.
Spattered across the wall?
Yeah, it's so gruesome.
And that's a network television show.
All the subtlety is just taken away. Really a different kind of show. And I really think that the actor,
Mads Mikkelsen.
Mads Mikkelsen, thank you.
He's miscast,
and he's just doing an impression of Hopkins' version.
I don't think he's doing an impression. There's nothing wrong with taking it your own way, but
I
don't think he's doing anything at all.
He's trying very hard to have that very controlled, cold, emotionless manner that Hopkins has. But he just isn't as good. And it's hard to live up to one of the greatest performances in Hollywood history.
All right, Scott Glenn is Jack Crawford. We've seen him 3 times now. People are not going to remember, probably, but he was in 2 '70s films, Nashville and Apocalypse Now. 3 very different roles and all supporting performances, of course. And this character, Jack Crawford, has been played by 4 pretty major actors. Dennis Farina played him in Manhunter, then it was Glenn's turn, then Harvey Keitel played him in Red Dragon, and Lawrence Fishburne's been playing him on the Hannibal TV show. Some other important supporting performances, Frankie Faison, who was in Do the Right Thing, is Barney. Roger Corman, who plays the FBI chief, and he's also in The Godfather Part 2, was cast by Francis Ford Coppola in a small role in that film. And he's been in other directors' films because he was a mentor of many major players over the history of the last 60 or so years of the business. Coppola learned under him, so did Scorsese, so did Demme, so did Ron Howard, so did Jack Nicholson, obviously he's an actor, and Peter Bogdanovich. Everybody in that list I just mentioned, except for Ron Howard, has made one or many AFI films, and they maybe wouldn't have ever been found or had the same kind of chance had it not been for Roger Corman, so kudos to him. George Romero, Night of the Living Dead director, has a very small role when Clarice is hustled out of the Tennessee location, and that is the one and only time that our hero and villain ever have any physical contact of any kind, because he strokes her finger, goodbye Clarice, as she takes her case file back. But the guy with the beer in the background is George A. Romero.
It's got to be in a movie if it's about cannibals.
That's a good point. I never thought about that. Probably a friend of Demme as well. And speaking of Demme, this is the only time we do him on the project. Not one of my favorite directors, but he's done some good movies. Something Wild is a favorite of many people. And then it's interesting that the movie he made after this, Philadelphia, this one's about some tough subject matter and was very controversial for that. And that one's Soft Soap, some very tough subject matter, which we've said on, I think it was Brokeback Mountain. You kind of have to. If you're going to bring in the subject of AIDS into Hollywood, you're not going to do it with something hardcore that maybe David Lynch or David Cronenberg would put out there.
Yeah, when we were doing the Brokeback podcast, we called it the Guess Who's Coming to Dinner of gay issues.
You're opening the door, yeah. Demme's made plenty of things since this era, but this was definitely his best time with Silence in Philadelphia. 2 major successes with big stars. Of course, Hanks was in Philadelphia along with Denzel Washington. His technique is interesting because you see a lot of this, I think in his whole career, but certainly in this movie, of straight-on camera shots. People look directly into the lens a ton. But he apparently didn't have Jodie Foster do it. She would just look off a little bit to the side. And the idea was, I don't know how this exactly works, but he's a director and I'm not, that you relate to her more. But Hopkins especially looks at the camera very often, which must be a weird technique for an actor, because I've heard the way they do that is the actor who's supposed to be the one they're looking at will stand as close as the camera as they can, or sit if they have to. So they're in the sight lines, but they're not looking their eyes, obviously, if that's the way it's
done.
They're
professional actors. They should be able to do it.
True. I always say that the green screen complaints about, I can act, George, and this... Well, you're supposed to pretend if you're on the stage and you're out there doing the Battle of Waterloo.
You're an actor. You play pretend for a living. You're already pretending to be a psychopathic killer. You can pretend that the camera is the person that you're talking to.
There's also quite a few reflections, especially in the aquarium, as I called it.
Sequences. Well used.
So then you can see both their faces on the screen at the same time quite a lot. The writer Ted Talley did write the sequel Red Dragon, and he was a consultant on the Shrek sequels. Isn't that curious? Not a ton of other credits. He's written some other things too, but those are some of his major ones. Thomas Harris's book was in 1988. He's a reclusive guy and didn't really want to be involved in the filming, but he was complimentary of the final product, and that's nice to hear because we've talked plenty about authors who trashed the movies that came out of their books.
Boy, the character of Hannibal Lecter has made that man a lot of money. Mm-hmm.
And Edward Saxon and Kenneth Utt were the producers. I believe it's Utt who's got that old man face in the autopsy scene, the guy who's just watching stuff go down. They both worked a lot with Demme in their careers. All right, technically the movie's 185:1 and watch the Blu-ray. Not the best looking print of all time, but it's fine. The cinematographer, Tak Fujimoto, he did shoot The Sixth Sense, so our last definite horror film. He was the man behind the camera for that, and he was a second unit guy on Star Wars, so three AFI films for him. Craig McKay was the editor. He was an assistant on The Exorcist. That movie comes up a lot with technical people. Funny how often it does. And lots of Demme projects for McKay as well. The composer, Howard Shore. It's the first time we've talked about him, and he's going to do our very last Top 100 Project film, The Lord of the Rings, The Fellowship of the Ring. He's worked with Cronenberg so often over the years, and now in more recent times it's been with Scorsese quite a lot. Great composer. All right, I always ask you this question. Did you like this score?
Yeah, I love the score because you don't notice it. It's not overkill. Not boring TV score either. It's something that's unique and
not too loud and not too overused.
Yeah, and it's creepy. Feels like a funeral song, like a requiem.
And sticking on the music tip, Mozart's The Magic Flute plays in the music box that Clarice finds in Frederica Bemmel, I believe, is her room. And that's a tune we heard in Amadeus because Mozart is the subject of Amadeus. Another thing I want to mention technically are the odd sounds in the cell, and actually in the little room where we see Barney before they even get to the cell, something like a hull of a ship or something, or a submarine.
Yeah.
The little control room when they go in there. We talked about how easy, well, maybe it's not easily, but how Lecter gets away in Tennessee. But when he's in the prison down in the basement, way down deep, even if he somehow got out of that plexiglass, he's not going to get through the bars to get to the little area to get into where Barney is. To get out of there, to get out of the whole hospital. He'd never do all those things. And there's also the guy with the guns in like another closed-off room. They've got their shit wired tight. But anyway, about the sounds. So there's great sounds there. And then, of course, also in James Gunn's basement production design down there. If we just wanted to watch the movie frame by frame down there, you'd see fascinating things the whole way.
We often joke the basement in our house is the murder basement because it has a dirt floor and it's really creepy down there. But the basement in Buffalo Bill's house, why is there a dry well down there? It's the creepiest basement of a house. And it's a labyrinth. It's enormous. It just keeps going. There's hallways and doors everywhere.
May have built that.
Presumably, that is the case. But it's almost over the top, except that at that point you've bought into the movie so completely, you're down with it.
If somebody's that obsessed with doing this, they'd maybe do whatever they have to make this work. And if you need yourself a dungeon, she's never going to climb out of there. That's a great shot, too, when the lotion in the basket's going up there and she sees the fingernail that's always been ripped right off of somebody and she starts losing her mind. That's the most emotional she is in the whole film, Brooke Smith's character. You don't need to see some flashbacks. So many movies would show the flashback. Oh my god, their nail rips off as Frederica tries to get out and then she doesn't make it.
Yeah, and his screaming along with her is also one of the creepiest. For me, it's one of the creepiest moments of the movie.
Because his whole point is, you can scream all you want to, you're not going anywhere, Demme.
But he also just seems to be feeling it. He just is that crazy. You can't predict the behavior of somebody who's lost their mind that completely, and that's what makes him so terrifying.
They're based in partly on Ted Bundy, also on Ed Gein, who's represented in Psycho, of course, Texas Chainsaw Massacre. But one more thing about the sound before I finish this, because I want to get to this point, that the sound guys for this film, and they were nominated for the Oscar. They were involved in 9 AFI films between them. Impressive total.
So before we get away from the topic of Buffalo Bill, I just want to quickly talk about transphobia. One of the reactions to this film is that the LGBT community criticized it because it had this bleak portrayal of transsexualism. And even though it's made clear in the film that he's nothing like the typical, I use quotation marks, passive transsexual, which is its own problematic statement because it lumps transgender in with other psychological disorders and kind of paints them with this brush. And I'll say what we said about a lot of films. Part of the problem with portraying a character like this is that there were no positive portrayals of transgendered people in 1991. You have Buffalo Bill, you have Norman Bates, you have Dressed to Kill. Or you have a transgendered character just standing in the butt of a joke, and the only thing I can think of right now for some reason is Crocodile Dundee grabs her crotch and not a man. That's my Australian accent, you're welcome. But we can happily say that there's been massive progress has been made just the last few years, really, between Transparent or Glee or Caitlyn Jenner and thousands of voices that have really changed the image. Glee, even Ryan Murphy, made this really progressive show just before that, made Nip Tuck, where there was a transgendered character who was a total villain, and you knew she was a villain as soon as you discover she was transgendered. It was the terrible Hollywood portrayal of transgender people. Thankfully, now we have progress in that arena, and there are a lot of positive portrayals to at least balance it.
Maybe even in 1991, they knew enough to point out, well, they shot the film in 1990, of course. And by the way, I talked about how Ryan was going under. They were going to release this film in late 90, but they didn't want to compete with Dances with Wolves. Mm-hmm. They thought that both movies had a chance to be awards nominated. Yeah. And of course, they both won a bunch. But maybe they realized back in that era that if you have Lecter say, and this may have been in the book, but if you have Lecter say, he's not a transsexual, but he thinks he is. Lecter kind of addresses the audience more so on that point than anyone in the movie. Mm-hmm. He's not even what he thinks he is, so he's not trying to represent that to all of you.
Yeah, which is probably a point that was never going to be made in Psycho, because...
But that was a twist, though. You can't reveal that beforehand.
That's true. And same with Dress to Kill.
And I think about controversy in this era with people who are LGBT. Basic Instinct was the year after this.
Mm-hmm.
Where, again, is, well, not all lesbians are killers. Maybe that one's a little bit more spurious with how they use that topic. But I think both movies can make the point that in our movie, these people are the bad guys. They are the killers. Okay, the influence. We've talked about it, plenty of it, so let's try to summarize. The Lecter sequel, Hannibal, in 2001, and the prequels, Manhunter, Red Dragon, and Hannibal Rising. We see him as a young kid and his sister, and all kinds of other stuff. We see why he became a cannibal. It was not a good movie. I saw it a long time ago and don't remember anything about it.
I don't remember it at all.
The Hannibal TV show is still on now. I think it's still being made, is it not?
It just got canceled.
Oh, what a shame. The Fava Beans and the Slurp are still parodied regularly to this day. Here's the second Kevin Smith reference in this podcast. Jason Mewes does the Goodbye Horses dance. That's the music that's playing when Buffalo Bill tucks his penis back and dances with the wig on his head. The scalped wig. Oh, that's really horrifying as well. He does that twice in Clerks. That's something that apparently Mewes would do just to entertain Kevin Smith. So they said, let's put it on screen.
And those are just the direct influences. I think it's fair to say that after Silence of the Lambs was such a great hit and cultural icon, probably every smart serial killer movie from that point on got greenlit for many, many years. And we probably have Silence of the Lambs to thank for some great movies like Seven or Usual Suspects, which isn't a serial killer movie, but again, it's about like a super smart villain. Movies like that got greenlit for many, many years and proved
still
to be
are.
Successful. I mean, everybody's always loved serial killers. It's hardly as if Silence of the Lambs invented the genre, but there was a spate of books and movies and TV shows.
I would say for sure. I'm
sticking
close to perfecting that genre.
Mm-hmm.
And they still make money off it to this day. And it so often is about a really smart serial killer who toys with the cop and maybe should just get the hell out of there.
And I think it introduced the audience to the character of the profiler a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
That definitely carried on in a lot of movies.
There was a show called The Profiler.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Okay, the awards and AFI list section. This is one of those movies that has a ton of these. It won the Big Five Oscars, so picture, director, actor, actress, and the screenplay, and the two failed nominations for editing and for sound. 1991 at the Oscars especially was the year of crime. All these movies won awards, and they're all, at least some way, if not majorly, about crime. JFK, Bugsy, Thelma and Louise, another feminist theme that same year, with two great lady characters, and Terminator 2. All have crime elements in them, and all Academy Award winners that year. It was a pretty strong year, like 1991. Congress put the Silence of the Lambs in the National Film Registry in 2011, only a couple years ago, the same year as Forrest Gump, which we cover in several weeks. And here are the AFI lists other than the main ones. The Census Taker, The Liver, The Beans, The Nice Chianti line was 21st on the Top 100 Quotes list. The movie was 5th on the Top 100 Thrills. Clarice was number 6 hero, Lecter number 1 villain on the Heroes and Villains list. And it was nominated for 3 others. The Top 100 Quotes, you said it much earlier, I'm having an old friend for dinner. Great last line. Buffalo Bill as a top 50 villain and the top 25 music scores. Actually, that's one of the best last lines in any movie, come to think of it.
Yeah.
Sure is Casablanca's last line is, and frankly, my dear, don't give a damn. I'm having an old friend for dinner. Great pun. Okay, parting thoughts.
Well, it's no secret. I just think this movie is fantastic. We talk about innovators and perfectors. It was a perfecter I can't think of any film that's done it better. Psycho maybe is the only example, but like I said earlier, I think it's up there with Psycho, and I'm really disappointed that it went down in the 2007.
Psycho's a terrific film. It has a much more plodding, slow pace. This one's actually very evenly paced. And as we said, not much action, but when it gets there, it really delivers that stuff.
And it's thoroughly entertaining from beginning to end.
And we'll definitely watch it again. That says an awful lot, too. Yeah. So in the 60s and then the 70s, where would you put it on your own list?
Oh, it would be my highest horror film or thriller film. It would be way up there, maybe in the top 25. Well, whatever. Like I said, it doesn't really matter what people want to call it. But for the type of movie it is, for a violent, thrilling movie, it would be one of the top of those for me and top 25.
I think I'd put it in my top 50 at the very least. That's enough about Silence of the Lambs. Up next on the Top 100 Project is the only Clint Eastwood AFI film in our final Western, Unforgiven. The coming attractions trivia for Unforgiven. How many people do we see Will Money gun down in Unforgiven?
All right, so for the answer to that question, please tune in to next week's podcast. If you'd like more trivia from Ryan and me, along with all kinds of other fun stuff, please go to our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the Top 100 Project on iTunes, and you can also find us on Podomatic, top100project.podomatic.com. You can email us at top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you guys. And once more, we would like to warmly thank our sponsor, Sparkplug Coffee.
I have no interest in calling on you, Bev. The world is more interesting with you in it.
And cut.